Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, how much does a president truly matter for the direction of the United States and for the rest of the world? We'll speak with two experts on the forces that imprison our presidents. But first, why are the number of insects in fast decline? What does it mean for our food supply and our long-term survival? Scientists say climate change is not the only reason. And we are joined now by Dr. Andrew DePaida. He's a researcher in the School of Biological Sciences at the University of Auckland, and we're discussing his most recent study, estimating the biodiversity of terrestrial invertebrates on forested land using DNA barcodes and meta-barcoding data. Welcome to the Scholar Circle. It's great to have you here with us. So we were reading a little bit about the biodiversity that you've been measuring, insects and how abundant they are. And perhaps it's really important for us to start with, what is their role? Like, why is this important that we understand what's happening with our insects?
Well, insects are one of the most diverse group of organisms on the planet. So there's millions of species of insects, basically. And I should probably mention other invertebrates as well, like invertebrates collectively are the majority of animals on Earth. So they're a really huge group, and we don't really understand much or know much about most of them just because of the sheer number of species there are. But it is known that they have important roles in ecosystems such as nutrient recycling and decomposition. Things like pollination, such as, you know, bees are an obvious example. They're really important for pollination of something like 80% of the world's crops. Also, just sort of direct inputs of nutrients into the soil, sort of shredding, decomposing stuff in the soil so it makes nutrients available to other things. Also, food web effects, such as predators have been found to have, like invertebrate predators, insect predators have been found to have effects on things like carbon cycling and nutrient mineralization. So there's a small range of insects that quite a lot is known about in terms of their roles in ecosystems, but there's also a vast array of other invertebrates and insects that we really don't know anything about, but it's fair to assume that they have a fairly important role in the ecosystems where they live.
So we're hearing a lot about decline of certain kinds of insects, and certainly we've heard about the bees, but I understand it's beyond the bees at this point. What do we know? Like, what is in decline? And how much is it in decline?
There have been a few studies looking at particular insects, such as certain butterflies, for example, which have shown that they've declined in species richness or abundance in particular locations over periods of several years to a decade or two. That kind of work hasn't been done on many species at all, however, although there was a recent study which looked at total insect biomass over a period of 27 years in Europe or in Germany, and they observed an 80% decline in insect biomass over that period, which is quite striking.
That is a big number.
And they didn't really, or were unable to attribute it to any particular cause. Things such as climate change and habitat degradation are often cited in biodiversity declines. In this case, they suspect it was possibly an effect of agricultural intensification.
So maybe we should talk about some of those things. Like, we know that climate change is heating up certain places and causing various types of ecosystem shifts that are making it harder for those organisms that live there to continue. But do you think you could help us to understand, like, what's causing decline there? So I saw that you looked at a forested area of New Zealand, for example.
Yeah.
What do we know about what's happening there and why?
In this particular island, which is called Hauturu or Little Barrier Island, we analyzed invertebrates from basically sea level up to the summit using DNA techniques. And this is a habitat which is very intact, basically. It's had some forest clearance and impacts such as that at the lower levels back in the 1800s, but unlike most other parts of New Zealand, there are no mammalian predators, and it's populated with a lot of endangered birds and also things such as the tuatara, which is an ancient reptile, and other organisms which are otherwise quite rare, if not extinct, on the mainland of New Zealand. So we concluded that there was something in the range of 6,000 invertebrate species on this island. That included about 4,000 insects, potentially. This was in considering both the things that live above the ground and also the invertebrates that live in the soil, which is a part of an ecosystem which is not often examined. So there's actually a lot of invertebrate biodiversity that's in the soil, as well as the things you more commonly see, such as, you know, the flying bees and moths and butterflies and so on.
So how would you compare what you have found in this remote island where there's really not a lot of degradation compared to another area that might be facing, like what you mentioned, you know, farm intensification?
When we analyzed the invertebrates on the island, we did that by looking at their DNA sequences. So we've got all that DNA sequence data, and we can match that up with DNA sequences from other invertebrates collected in other locations. So we could find out whether the same species are present in both places, or we can also use that data to determine how many different species there are. And we can compare the number of species on this island versus the number of species in another more degraded habitat. We do actually have data from some other places as well, and it appears that the island has considerably higher invertebrate biodiversity than we see in some mainland sites, although we haven't formally examined that as such yet.
Do you have a sense in other places what is causing a decline? And I guess as a part of that, should we be concerned?
The general sense seems to be that it's human development-associated factors which cause declines in invertebrate or insect biodiversity, such as urban development, habitat fragmentation, pollution, agriculture, use of pesticides, that sort of thing, which is it's the same set of things which typically feed into the extinction of other groups of organisms, such as birds and mammals as well. But the difference with invertebrates is that it hasn't really been recognized until recently that they're decreasing in terms of biodiversity or biomass until very recently. In New Zealand, we can say that there's a general decline in invertebrate biodiversity from native forest sites to agricultural sites, which is consistent with what has been observed elsewhere. It's consistent with these theories about habitat degradation and urban use of agricultural intensification and that sort of thing.
So how concerning is this to lose the biodiversity, particularly from invertebrates like insects?
I think it's very concerning, actually. There have been some perhaps alarmist estimates that insects will become extinct within a few decades based on current trends. But given the apparent role of invertebrates and insects in all sorts of ecosystem processes, it would be very disruptive if that group of organisms was basically removed from ecosystems everywhere. So it's obviously a concerning issue.
So give us some examples of, like, suppose we lose a certain number of these invertebrates from an ecosystem. I mean, would you be thinking there might be a tend towards an ecosystem collapse without them, or would there be an adaptation? I mean, what's your sense of this as a scientist?
My sense is that the effects would probably be a whole variety of things. I'm not sure whether they would extend to a complete ecosystem collapse. Perhaps at the extreme, if there were no invertebrates present whatsoever, that would happen. But to give obvious examples, if you removed the pollinator invertebrates from a system, then the plants wouldn't be able to reproduce and develop. Another example I'm aware of is that removing predatory beetles from, or predatory insects, I'm not sure if they're beetles actually, from a particular habitat had an effect on the dung beetles. So it changed the degree to which carbon was brought into the soil and made available for primary plant growth and that sort of thing. So there'd be probably a whole array of different effects depending on the particular invertebrates that were involved.
So if you were going to be advising, say, policymakers about where we need to be going from here, from a scientific point of view, what would you say?
I would suggest that some things that could be done would be trying to limit the use of pesticides in agricultural contexts, ensuring that agricultural areas include a range of plants and habitats within that, so that you're basically providing a place for the invertebrates and the insects to live. rather than allowing these sort of monocultures of one crop, which and then blasting it with herbicides and pesticides to try and maintain that one crop, you basically need to have a variety of spaces and resources and a lack of pollution and pesticides that in order to enable a rich invertebrate community to exist. So any move in that sort of direction, I think, would be helpful.
Well, Andrew DePaita, it's great to have you here with us on the Scholar Circle. Thank you so much for sharing your research and your wisdom with us.
Thank you for having me.
That was Dr. Andrew DePaita. He's a researcher in the School of Biological Sciences at the University of Auckland. And we've been discussing his latest study, estimating the biodiversity of terrestrial invertebrates on forested land using DNA barcodes and meta-barcoding data. When we come back, how much does a president truly matter for the direction of the United States and for the rest of the world? How will climate change affect the next president's agenda? We'll speak with two experts on the forces that imprison our presidents. Stay tuned. You are listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. How much does the president truly matter for the direction of the United States and for the rest of the world? We're joined by William Grover and Joseph Peshek. William Grover is professor of political science at St. Michael's College in Vermont and the author of The President as Prisoner. Joseph Peshek is professor of political science at Hamline University in St. Paul, Minnesota, and the author of Policy Planning Organizations, Elite Agendas in America's Rightward Turn. Together, they have co-authored the book we'll be talking about, The Unsustainable Presidency, Clinton, Bush, Obama, and Beyond. Welcome to the Scholar Circle. It's great to have the two of you here with us. I thought the way you opened the book was quite compelling with this BP oil spill and President Obama's response to it, and his daughter asking her dad if he had plugged the hole yet. How do you see this as indicative of the unsustainable presidency? Bill Grover?
Well, first of all, thanks for having us on, Maria. The example was used to point out the fact that in the 20th and 21st centuries, the public kind of expects the president, regardless of party, to respond to all manner of crises in the world and crises at home. And we're just trying to point out that that attitude that the president is the first kind of place you go to for correcting problems, that attitude is fairly new. It's kind of a New Deal, a post-New Deal phenomenon. And that when you look at the 19th and 20th centuries, in fact, people with grievances would look more to their state governments or to Congress for help, not to the president. So we're just trying to make a point there about how people's view of the office and the importance of office and the centrality of the office in helping people with their lives, that view has shifted over time.
Joe Peshek, what would you add?
Well, as Bill pointed out, there's been a shift in public perceptions of the presidency. And I guess what we're doing in a nutshell is not trying to argue that the presidency is not powerful, is not unimportant, but to look at the underlying factors in society, in our economic system, the constraints that limit, by and large, the range of actions presidents can take, at least on, you know, very important economic, foreign policy, national security issues, and so forth. And so we're trying to draw attention to ways in which social conditions and things other than just like the president's relationship with Congress, which of course is very important, but things a little bit more structural sort of shape the terrain on which presidents ask, but I may be kind of anticipating a later discussion.
Yeah, definitely. But that's okay. You gave us a little preview. I think there's a lot in there that I want to get into. I wonder if we could talk about, before we even get into the kind of structural analysis that you guys did, particularly as it links to Bill Grover's previous work, The President is Prisoner, which I always found to be a fascinating idea. But before we even get there, I wonder if we could walk through how much the presidency has changed over time in terms of what the job really entails. You did this really wonderful job in the first chapters talking about the various presidents and what their approach was, as well as the different theoretical ideas. If Bill Grover, why don't you give us a sense of how things have changed?
It's a good question. Public expectations have certainly risen, but here's a little experiment you could do in LA or where you are now in New Zealand. Just go ask somebody on the street to name a 19th century president. And if you get somebody to mention someone other than Abraham Lincoln, you're pretty lucky. Particularly, name a president after the Civil War in the 19th century. It's not impossible, but most people have no idea. The president was not that central a figure in public life. So with the exception of Lincoln, acting in times of crisis, in fact, the greatest crisis the U.S. ever faced during the Civil War, with the almost lone exception of Lincoln, people could come up with some names, but wouldn't really know much of anything, if at all, about those presidencies, because in fact, the presidency wasn't that central a figure, a player in the American political economy for most of the 19th century. They basically did the bidding of business, particularly after the Civil War. They basically did the bidding of big business during the Industrial Revolution and the Gilded Age. And beyond that, the president really wasn't responding to popular concerns. That obviously changes with FDR in the teeth of the New Depression, in the teeth of the Great Depression, and the New Deal programs that came forward. But you know, prior to Roosevelt, it was not a particularly executive-centered view of the world.
Would you say that from early in the U.S. history that this bidding for big business has really been the central focus even from the very beginning?
Well, that's a very interesting question. And of course, the economy of the United States has changed tremendously. And if I can refer to a popular, I think, Broadway play, Hamilton, we talked a little bit about Alexander Hamilton's analysis of the presidency early on, who really did see a kind of a link between a strong presidency and an active state and working with the major financial and manufacturing sectors of the economy to promote national development. But I guess I would say that Hamilton might be kind of a forerunner of the corporate state that really developed in the 20th century, where you had the development of large corporations and financial institutions. So you know, I think our analysis kind of focuses on the so-called modern presidency, which most political scientists, including ourselves, would date from FDR, although there were some earlier hints of that earlier in the 20th century. But the connection between the corporate model of economic growth and the presidency is, at least to my way of thinking, and Bill might disagree with this, is the development of corporate capitalism we see in the late 19th and the 20th century. And it was a somewhat different system before that.
Bill Grover, do you agree?
Yeah, I agree with that. I do agree with that. And I think that Joe is correct that Hamilton was ahead of his time. He had a vision. I tell my students sometimes that Hamilton's the most important political figure they've never heard of or can't even explain. No, yeah, we hear a lot about Washington and Jefferson and maybe even James Madison, but until this play came along, people hadn't paid a lot of attention to Hamilton, at least not in popular culture. But he was way, way ahead of his time, as Joe said, in terms of using the a combination of business power and political power to get things done. And until the United States emerges from the Civil War and actually can begin to develop a national economy, until that happens, Hamilton's plans, although the plan for the National Bank was there before that, but other than the plan for the National Bank, Hamilton's vision is not really realized until the latter part of the 19th and throughout the 20th century.
But you were critical of, say, for example, Woodrow Wilson's assertion that he was for big business but opposed to monopolies, monopolistic trusts. How does this all fit in with your argument? Bill Grover.
Well, I think coming out of the progressive era, Wilson was, as were many progressives, not that he was a progressive, but many people were very, very wary of corporate power. Louis Brandeis, the Supreme Court Justice, talked about how we can have, you know, democracy on the one hand, or we can have concentration of corporate power on the other hand, but we can't have both. So the idea that corporate power during Wilson's time could undermine democracy was there, but in no way were those folks, particularly Wilson, critical of capitalism as an economic system. They were critical of massive concentrations of corporate power, but they didn't have a fundamental criticism of the way that the business in general interacts with the political sphere. So sure, so when we use that one quote from Wilson that frames a second chapter, it's an interesting quote. He takes the argument up to a certain point, but beyond that point, he's not going to be critical of the economic system per se, only the excesses of the economic system in the hands of corporate power, as seen throughout the progressive era, when a critique of that became very, very important.
And if I could just add to that briefly, we have to remember in the early parts of the 20th century, there was a real upsurge of various types of radicalism in the United States, the labor movement, anarchism, socialism, radical feminism, new black strivings, W.E.B. Du Bois. And so, yeah, that's also a context, because there were definitely people in what we might call the establishment who were very nervous that, you know, these sorts of calls for fundamental change and radicalism might go too far. And the more far-sighted members of the ruling group, in which I would include Wilson, sort of recognized that in order to maintain the system that we have, we're going to have to make certain concessions. And the same could be said of FDR, by the way, too. FDR in 1936, when he was running for election, I mean, he did sort of excoriate those who hated him, but he also said, we saved the system. So that's the kind of perspective we're bringing to sort of see this balancing act where presidents kind of have to lift themselves up from any one particular economic group in order to devise plans to maintain the system as a whole.
And if I could just add to that, when we're challenging the conventional faith that the institutions of government, particularly the executive branch interacting with the legislative branch, when he and I challenged this conventional faith that the institutions will self-correct, when we challenge that, we emphasize there's a very, very powerful political and economic structure, but we also emphasize, of course, the efficacy of social movements, that the only way you can really challenge that kind of structural corporate political power nexus is with social movements. And so when Joe points out that during the progressive era, and again, certainly during the Great Depression and the New Deal, those social movements were absolutely crucial in extracting concessions from political and economic leaders.
Well, I thought that your examples, both in this book and Bill Grover in your previous book, that were most powerful were the ideas of the economic strike, of the economic elite going on strike, and what that really does to an economy. And that's how power gets checked in presidents, whoever the president might be. And you used several examples of this. So why don't you explain exactly what you mean by this structure that keeps presidents in check and keeps their power limited?
The structural argument that we make throughout the book suggests that both in terms of how, regardless of party, whether a Democrat or Republican is in the White House, regardless of the personality, whether their personality is more outgoing or inward looking, regardless of their management style, are they good delegators, or are they people who like to keep control of the details themselves, regardless of those are the kind of factors that conventional political science look to when they analyze the executive in the White House. And what Joe and I are suggesting is that what lies beneath the party and the personality and the management style is a certain definition of economic growth and a certain definition of national security, both of which are absorbed by both political parties. So that when, for example, you're trying to explain why every 4 years people get all excited about this quadrennial hoopla thing we call the presidential election, people get really excited about it, and you know, voter turnout in 2008 can skyrocket for Barack Obama and can remain pretty healthy in 2012. People get their expectations up pretty high, maybe not so much in 2016, but they often get their expectations up very, very high. And one of the questions that Joe and I was probing was, why are those expectations so routinely shattered on the shoals of reality? And in part because both parties share a similar definition of economic growth and national security, and so that the political and economic structure frames issues, policy issues, in ways that are in line with kind of conventional definitions of growth. You know, how do we define growth? We should define economic growth as, let's have greater gross domestic product this year than we had last year. Let's have greater GDP next year than we had this year, on and on and on, up and up and up. And that kind of logic of economic growth that both parties are absorbed in, all you have to do is listen to Hillary Clinton in that first debate talk about her belief in economic growth. That view of economic growth is no longer sustainable in an era of climate change. And so, and similarly, in an era of declining U.S. power in the world, declining U.S. hegemony, the idea that we can pursue national security with just bigger defense budgets and by being militarily assertive, kind of national security credo that we talk about in some of our other articles, those assumptions are no longer sustainable either in a world of declining U.S. power. So the structure is the way that conventional thinking frames in both political parties the way we address the key policy issues. Are there differences in policy issues? Of course. If you are a huge supporter of LGBT rights, then it makes a difference that there's a Democrat in the White House or versus a Republican. But when it comes to the major kind of definitional issues of the modern presidency, a certain definition of economic growth, endless economic growth, and a certain definition of national security, you're not going to get much difference from the two political parties. And that's because the debate is structured in certain ways that reflect political and economic power.
Joe Peschek?
Well, I think you mentioned the idea of the capital strike, Maria, and that would be one example of how structural economic factors could affect the presidency. And, you know, in a nutshell, it's that presidents are so sensitive to the views of the business community, because in a capitalist society, the investment and employment decisions of the business community make a big difference in the state of the economy, and the state of the economy matters greatly to presidents, that they have what some scholars would call kind of an automatic punishing mechanism. I mean, in the sense that presidents, knowing that capital might go on strike if they don't like the policies of the presidency, acts to block a presidency from pursuing more progressive policies in the first place. And actually, this idea has been developed by people from a number of different perspectives, not just on the left, but Charles Lindblom, for example, famously, who was president of the American Political Science Association. So that's a kind of a structural factor that doesn't really require business corporations, for example, to explicitly lobby the government. It's just, again, it's kind of a recoil mechanism, you know, the belief in business confidence. Now, one other point, I think we use the term structural maybe a little bit eclectically. We talk about capital dominance and class dominance. And so the capital strike might be kind of the dominance of capital just per se. But we also acknowledge that one of the ways in another type of structural constraint is just the massive advantages that corporations and the wealthy have to influence government through more voluntary means, like campaign contributions, like lobbying, like having their representatives appointed to government or to set up think tanks that influence the policy process. So we're calling, you know, both of those levels corporate influence structural, at least with respect to economic issues.
Could you say what you mean by capitalist strike?
Capitalist strike is the ability of large corporations to punish policymakers for the policy decisions, to punish them instantaneously through changes in investment policies and employment policies that are registered daily on the stock market and in other ways as well. So, for example, if you really had a push for the 15-hour minimum wage, if you really had a push for something even much more radical than if Bernie Sanders, for example, had won the Democratic nomination and was really pushing for national health care or something, the threat of serious challenges to the way we normally define economic growth would encourage businesses to go on strike. The word strike is in quotes. It's the kind of business version of a labor strike, whereas a labor strike requires lots of coordination and lots of hardship on the part of ordinary people, perhaps losing their jobs or perhaps going on strike and not having a paycheck for a week or two or three. Capital strike happens instantaneously when businesses shift their investments at the stroke of a computer key, and those register daily in terms of a declining stock market. So, for example, when Joe and I talked about, well, in our sixth chapter, we speculate, well, what would have, this was well before Bernie Sanders declared his run for the presidency, when we suggested, okay, what would happen if Bernie Sanders was actually to win the nomination for the presidency? And we talk about how the reaction of business would be swift and negative, and that even before, you know, weeks and weeks and weeks before he would take the oath of office in January of 2017, successful candidate Bernie Sanders in November of 2016 would be facing declining business confidence and a capital strike, and would have to then be called upon to do things like perhaps he would be pressured to change the appointments to tailor the appointments he would make to his cabinet during his honeymoon period. I'm sorry, the period before he takes the oath of office. He would be highly pressured to appoint into key positions, the Commerce Department and Treasury Department and such, the kinds of people who would mollify and calm the markets. And so that's why you get, for example, when Barack Obama came to power in 2009, you get what was sometimes referred to as his economic aid team, you know, Robert Rubin and Larry Summers and Tim Geithner and those kinds of guys. Now, Obama wasn't facing capital strike, but they would be, if you really had a candidate who fundamentally challenged the power structure, you would have tremendous pressure during that 11-week period to name people to key positions who would mollify those who might engage in capital strikes. So there would be tremendous pressure to do that. And so we're trying to talk about that as part of the structural factor.
When you say capitalist strike, you could also think of that in terms of investor panic, right? Institutional investor panic. Meaning,
yes.
Yeah. So they panic because they're like, oh, my God, we're turning to an anti-business climate or whatever. They pull their money out of the stock market. The stock market falls. And then perhaps what happens is that unemployment goes up. So it becomes a national problem.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. And that could happen. The point you make in Chapter 6 of the book is during that 11-week transition period, that's when the pressure would be probably most powerful for a different kind of candidate who might want to really challenge that structure. That's when the pressure would be most powerful to make appointments that would reflect a more pro-business point of view. And we're not going to get to see that with Bernie Sanders because he didn't win the nomination, but that was kind of a thought experiment we did to get people thinking about how that structure actually operates. And the interesting point that Lindblom and others have made is in no way is this a conspiracy theory argument. Businesses don't have to collude with one another to withhold investment or to lay off workers. It just happens through the normal process of business leaders making individual business decisions for their shareholders. So there's no conspiracy. There's no need to coordinate that. It happens as a normal fundamental flow of capitalism.
It's really a psychological response, as I see it, and also a little bit of groupthink that goes along with that.
Yeah, I think the psychological piece was sometimes referred to as maintaining business confidence, that confidence that whoever's in the White House is going to be supportive of those needs. There's a psychological dimension for sure.
Just a reminder that you are listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. We're joined by William Grover and Joseph Peshek. William Grover is professor of political science at St. Michael's College in Vermont. Joseph Peshek is professor of political science at Hamline University in St. Paul, Minnesota. Together, they have co-authored The Unsustainable Presidency, Clinton, Bush, Obama, and Beyond. Let's put some of the policies that you examined from the last three presidents into this context and help us to understand why things went the way they did, both with economic issues and also with foreign policy. So maybe we should start with Bill Clinton. Joe Peshek?
Of course, Bill Clinton, too, ran on a campaign of change in 92 and ending three terms for the Republicans having the White House. And when he campaigned for president, he said he was concerned about the budget deficit, but he also, just to take this one issue, said we have a public investment deficit as well, and I want to spend money on infrastructure, on job training, and a number of other things. Okay, and he prioritized that. But, you know, as an example of what we were just talking about in this business confidence argument, even during the transition, after he had been elected, but before he became president in January of 93, he learned that the federal budget deficit was higher than had been forecast and immediately came under pressure from Federal Reserve Chair Alan Greenspan and other people that, you know, dealing with the economy really requires reinsuring financiers and investors that we can bring the budget deficit down. And as it turned out, Clinton's public investment, a more progressive side of his legislation, was largely jettisoned. It had a lot of opposition from the Republicans. I don't want to minimize that. And you know, he found himself increasingly focused on deficit reduction. And as we explained, quoting an account from Bob Woodward, he himself recognized that his agenda was to some extent being dictated by the need to satisfy the bond market, okay, very famously, and that, you know, he was caught in a quandary he didn't quite control, because now the agenda was, in order to restore economic growth, we have to take measures to reinsure investors, and what they want to see is a focus on budget reduction rather than public investment. So I think, actually, you know, the early Clinton presidency, particularly his first budget battles, do illustrate pretty well the kind of pressures that Bill was just talking about that presidents face to reassure the business community. And of course, many other examples could be given from Clinton, too, and then foreign policy as well.
Bill Grove, is there anything you'd like to add to that?
So just to take that story even forward beyond 1993, so when Joe talks about that kind of policy, you could also add to that in 1999, for example, the repeal of Glass-Steagall, which Clinton was hugely in favor of, that the 1933 law that separated commercial banking from investment banking. And with the repeal of Glass-Steagall, every bank was allowed to play, you know, part of casino capitals, involve themselves in big investments. And so the repeal of Glass-Steagall, lowering the capital gains tax rate, collectively what became known as Clintonomics, was really a fairly conservative approach, a fairly neoliberal approach to economic policy. And you could see that also in welfare reform when he ran for re-election in 1996. And so when it comes to NAFTA or welfare reform or the repeal of Glass-Steagall, a whole range of economic policies, the budget battles that Joe referred to, you can see that kind of set of priorities was at work for Bill Clinton, and certainly was at work later on for Barack Obama too, who also campaigned on a change you can believe in. So I think that adherence to late 1980s, early 1990s neoliberal policies is a constant now for the chief executive, be he or she a Democrat or a Republican. So that also helps explain, I think, people's dissatisfaction that change doesn't really happen. But with Clinton, he was part of that Democratic Leadership Council, New Democrat response, which really was a more conservative Democratic Party after Joe said three consecutive terms with Republicans in charge.
What about with foreign policy?
A couple of points there with respect to Clinton specifically. He's the first president elected after the fall of the Cold War. And the 1990s were also the issue, the decade in which globalization became a buzzword. So just to take those up, in terms of globalization, the Clinton administration, we think, really embraced neoliberalism, not just in terms of domestic policy, but in terms of international economic policy too. Most notably in so-called free trade agreements like NAFTA, and just in terms of the general paradigm that the opening of markets will lead to democracy, democratization will lead to peace. I mean, there was a very strong neoliberal streak to Clinton's approach to global political economy. The other thing, though, in terms of national security policy is it's really significant that, you know, Clinton did actually deploy military force on quite a number of occasions, maybe more than people realize, in the Balkans and also against Iraq, too. And it was under Clinton that the I'm misremembering the name of the legislation, but sort of calling for regime change in Iraq was passed, something that he, in the 1998 legislation that Clinton supported, and in some ways signals George W. Bush's war against Iraq in the next decade. So, overall, we see Clinton, even though, you know, it's a post-Cold War period, you think, well, the Soviet Union not around anymore, and so that will lead to a new American national security strategy. I mean, the emphasis on American global leadership or hegemony, you know, we think that's the real, you know, key factor. Cold War or not, again, modern American presidents, be they Democrat or Republican, liberal or conservative, are very much committed to the goal of maintaining American global dominance And of course, to justify that, we hear so much about American exceptionalism, you know, and we hear that from Hillary Clinton, we hear that from Republicans. That's kind of the ideology that supports it, I might say. So that would be my take on foreign policy. I mean, it's a big topic, but really we think that Clinton kind of carried on the national security imperative that we talk about in a post-Cold War setting.
If we were to compare, say, the last three presidents, Clinton, Bush, Barack Obama, I know that you said you see quite a bit of continuity across them, particularly with economic policies, but we also see differences. How important are those differences, Bill Grover?
I think the differences are often emphasized a lot by the media because it helps reinforce the idea that we have, you know, two vibrant different points of view that are contesting for, you know, economic policy and foreign policy issues. So I think that we often hear about the differences, but I think substantively in terms of the actual conduct of U.S. foreign policy, one could make an argument, for example, that the pervasive use of drone strikes in Pakistan and Yemen and other countries, Afghanistan, by President Obama, was actually exceeded the amount of interventionism that President George W. Bush engaged in. Of course, he had the war in Iraq, the start of the war in Iraq. But I think you see, I think the differences are dwarfed by the continuities. They're dwarfed by the continuities, which tends to look at, which strongly looks at foreign policy through an economic lens and through a lens of strengthening U.S. power in the world. So, for example, with Bill, going back to Bill Clinton, I mean, he often talked when it came to foreign policy in terms of geoeconomics. And so trade agreements like the North American Free Trade Agreement or the World Trade Organization, for him, and I think also for President Obama, pursuing U.S. corporate economic interests abroad are reinforced by our trade policies and by our foreign policy. And I think that the similarities on that really dwarf the differences. There's a quote, a really kind of interesting quote that Joe and I have used in the book, and it's a quote from National Security NSA Director General Keith Alexander. He was commenting on the policy continuity between George W. Bush and Obama in the spring of 14. And he argued, you would get almost the same decision from both of them, Bush and Obama. You'd get almost the same decision from both of them on key questions about how to defend our nation from terrorists and other threats. It almost doesn't matter who's in the White House from his point of view. And you don't, that level of frankness, you don't get very often. But in that particular moment, he's kind of pointing out that that regardless of whether the president is Democrat or Republican, you're going to get a very, very similar view of U.S. foreign policy. You might see another example of that, I think, with the passing of Shimon Peres in Israel, and you're going to get the same kind of a praise for him from both political parties, be it Hillary Clinton or, you know, Donald Trump or anybody else.
And Obama's going to his funeral along with Bill Clinton, and I'm not sure. George, it'll be Bush taking along too. That's possible.
I wouldn't be surprised if he went. But, yeah.
You know, not to undercut our argument, and this doesn't, but there are differences in sort of ruling circles about what the best strategy is for attaining the goals of economic growth and American global dominance. And so there are differences between the Bush administration, the Obama administration, and there are also differences within each administration, sort of internal factions. But for example, under Obama, he's appointed people who are regarded in terms of national security as quite liberal. Samantha Powers, maybe Susan Rice, but you know, they're liberal hawks too. That's the thing. And they, the neoliberal hawks or the liberal hawks in many ways share commitments to American military intervention and so forth with the neoconservatives who we heard so much about under George W. Bush. So, you know, it's not a static set of imperatives. It gets played out in different ways, and there are different kind of debates over what strategies and particular policies would best ensure the overall goals. And, you know, I think we tried to take that into account, too.
We have seen differences with economic approaches domestically. So, for example, we do see big economic downturns under presidents like Bush, and we see them getting considerably better under President Obama, although the economic inequality continues.
There are differences, Maria, for sure. And we're not at all suggesting, as Joe said, we're not at all suggesting that there aren't differences, but we just think that the similarities are much greater. So both President George W. Bush and Barack Obama had economic recovery packages that they stimulus packages that they got through Congress. They were similar in size, the high $700 billion range. Both were going to help bail out Wall Street in response to the Great Recession. They very, very similar kind of policy, but there are differences in terms of how they sell those policies and differences in terms of whether they believe the government intervention per se can have a helpful impact. President Bush, George W. Bush, had to be dragged kicking and screaming into supporting a stimulus package, and Barack Obama was much more supportive, but he was not at all supportive of the size of a stimulus package, for example, that many, many economists, liberal and radical economists, said the stimulus package should be more in the range of $1.5 trillion perhaps. So they're both neither one is going to really endorse a massive investment strategy to bail us out, or to bail out the ordinary person as opposed to bailing out Wall Street. Maybe even a better example would be the Affordable Care Act, which I think we are better off that the Affordable Care Act was passed. I think that, with having an additional 26 million people have health care is a wonderful thing. But, there was no fire in the belly in Congress, and certainly none from President Obama in terms of having a public option. It was on the table very briefly. Public option, it might move us towards single payer. So the Affordable Care Act is going to get no Republican support, got no Republican support in Congress. The Democrats are going to support that. That's a difference. That's a significant difference. And I think it would be silly to say that wasn't a difference. It is important that we've had that piece of legislation pass. So that's the difference. But the similarity is that neither party is going to champion, maybe outside Bernie Sanders, is going to champion a single payer healthcare system along the lines of a Canadian system or a German system or a French system. So there are differences. And there are similarities, but we think overall the differences, the barriers beyond which neither party will go, are pretty similar.
Just a reminder that you are listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. We're joined by William Grover and Joseph Peshek. William Grover is professor of political science at St. Michael's College in Vermont. Joseph Peshek is professor of political science at Hamline University in St. Paul, Minnesota. Together, they have co-authored The Unsustainable Presidency, Clinton, Bush, Obama, and Beyond. If we look at your essential thesis about an unsustainable presidency, there's a big problem of climate change before us. There's also a big problem of economic inequality and poverty. When we look forward, how do we see this going versus given climate change, given the level of economic quality, and given the upheavals in the world?
Well, that's a nice small question to take on. We are sort of asserting that the approaches that presidents have been committed to on all of the issues you just mentioned are unsustainable in the long run. Now, as John Maynard Keynes once said, in the long run, we are all dead. So, that's a very good question. I would say Bill knows a lot more about the politics of climate change than I do, but that is something that if the forecasts are true about how rapidly, even more rapidly than we feared, these changes are coming about. I mean, the actual effects of that inside the United States and out in terms of extreme climate changes, extreme weather, I mean, I just think that's going to be unignorable. And we see some signs of that. And so it will be very interesting to see. I mean, we would say that to really deal with climate change, radical changes in our economic system or consumption patterns are needed. But, there's no doubt about it that there will probably be, corporate models of dealing with climate change with, a sort of system maintaining approaches that will be put out there. So, I think just to deal with the politics of climate change, I mean, I think that's going to be an unignorable problem that you can't sweep under the rug, in which maybe you can sweep economic inequality under the rug indefinitely. But then how is the problem going to be defined and what's going to be done about it? That's going to be very contested, I think. And I don't think we'll have to wait decades for that, actually. I think that's looming very, very near.
And so to take
tear that apart, well, like.
No, I'm not going to tear it apart. But to take it back to your prior question, Maria, about differences versus similarities. There are differences between the two parties on climate change, for sure. By and large, with some exceptions, by and large, the Republican Party does not even acknowledge that climate change is a problem. All right, they're not all climate deniers, but they're climate skeptics. At a minimum, they're climate skeptics. Democrats, no Democrat worth his or her salt is going to deny the existence of climate change. Democrats will talk about it some. Barack Obama has talked about it some. We reached an agreement in Paris early December, the climate change agreement. So Democrats are going to talk about it. They're not going to deny it. They're certainly going to, like Hillary Clinton on a campaign trail with income inequality and wealth inequality, she acknowledges it. She talks about it. But when it comes to climate change, or inequality for that matter, no Democrat is going to be willing to say, okay, we have to keep the global average temperature rise below 2 degrees Celsius, or we're in deep trouble. We've gone way, way, way above 350 parts per million CO2 concentration. We're up to 403, 404 parts per million. No Democrats will acknowledge that. They'll acknowledge the extreme nature of the situation. They'll talk about the need for change, as President Obama has. But as Joe suggested, no Democrat is really going to talk about actually consuming less, that we need to consume less as a nation. It's hard, and this is why the climate change issue is so fundamentally linked to inequality. It's one thing to say, you know, Donald Trump and, for that matter, Bill Grover, Joe Pesci, and Maria Armodian, they should consume less. Maybe we could, but it, you know, with income and wealth inequality, it's hard to ask somebody who's living on, you know, $31,000 a year to consume less. So I get it. There's the income and wealth inequality has a huge impact on climate change. But no Democrat is going to fundamentally say we need to really check corporate power. We need to consume less. They're all going to talk about growth, growth, growth all the time. They'll use terms like sustain. I think Hillary Clinton used the term sustainable growth. They're going to talk about growth as having to continue indefinitely. And even though they're going to not acknowledge that, in fact, that kind of growth, or just burning the fossil fuels that we already have ready to go, as Bill McKibben has pointed out so many times with 350.org, no Democrat's going to say we really need to keep that coal and that natural gas and that oil. We really, really need to keep it in the ground. ExxonMobil has plans to refine that oil, turn it into gasoline, and make a heck of a profit off of it, and ditto for fracking, and ditto for natural gas and everything else. So Democrats are going to talk about climate change. That's a difference. It's a rhetorical difference. Democrats are going to even take some steps toward addressing climate change, but neither party is really going to have the political and economic will to really advocate for the kinds of changes we'd have to do to actually keep the global average temperature below, say, 2 degrees or 2.2 degrees Celsius. So are there differences? Absolutely. Some of them are rhetorical, and some of them are real. I mean, you know, Keystone XL pipeline, that project really was stopped by President Obama after massive, massive, massive social pressure. But there's the Dakota Access Pipeline. There's new pipelines being proposed all the time. So the Democrats are not going to fundamentally challenge the corporate position on climate change. In fact, what they're going to do is do what President Obama has done, and that's say, you know, the issue here is energy independence. You know, we need all the sources. We need to focus on solar, focus on geothermal, focus on wind, but also focus on all the others. We need to be – and once the issue was framed as climate – once the issue was framed as energy independence, then Democrats could talk about reducing fossil fuels. They could talk about wind. They could talk about solar, but still not have to really fundamentally challenge our consumption patterns. So are there differences? Yes, but the similarities to me seem to dwarf the differences.
That's actually a point I wanted to make a little bit earlier, Maria, about differences between the two parties. I mean, their policy differences do reflect the fact that they have somewhat different bases in terms of demographics, in terms of voting groups, in terms of expectations by, for example, organized labor, which though still, though much shrunken from what it was 50 years ago, is still an important factor in the Democratic Party.
Within to take that just one step further with organized labor, the AFL-CIO and other unions, on an issue like NAFTA, I mean, organized labor was strongly against NAFTA in 1993, and they lobbied against it. They practically begged Bill Clinton to not
to not endorse NAFTA, but he did anyway, and it was passed through Congress. And and organized labor, even though they were huge campaign contributors to Clinton, and they were going to be huge campaign contributors to Hillary Clinton too, even though that's a big part of the Democratic base, the continuity between the two parties is that, in fact, you still get NAFTA, you still get TPP, you still get the World Trade Organization with Democrats as well as Republicans. So even when an economic factor within the party in terms of fundraising, like organized labor, even when you factor that in, it still doesn't necessarily change policy. We have not had a major piece of labor legislation really in this country since the Occupational Safety and Health Act of 1970. Yes, occasionally we'll get an increase in the minimum wage, but I would not call that a major labor policy. We haven't had a major piece of labor legislation for quite some time, and organized labor had high hopes that that President Barack Obama would help them much, much more than he has.
The book is called The Unsustainable Presidency, and we've been speaking with the authors William Grover and Joseph Peshek. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Maria.
Thanks for having us very much.
William Grover is professor of political science at St. Michael's College in Vermont and the author of The President as Prisoner. Joseph Peshek is professor of political science at Hamline University in St. Paul, Minnesota, and the author of Policy Planning Organizations, Elite Agendas in America's Rightward Turn. Together, they have co-authored the book The Unsustainable Presidency, Clinton, Bush, Obama, and Beyond. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.